information provided in this podcast is general in nature. All medical and surgical procedures have potential benefits and risks. Please consult an ophthalmologist for medical advice specific to your individual patients.
Hi, my name is Christina Icavangelo, and on behalf of the Clinical Relationships team at Vision Eye Institute, I'd like to welcome you to our podcast series, Shared Vision, Shared Care. In each episode, I will be joined by two of Vision Eye Institute's ophthalmologists, and we will discuss a collaborative care approach on various subspecialties. As a clinical optometrist myself, it is our aim that this series will strengthen the relationship between referrers and ophthalmologists, one where you will feel confident knowing when to refer, what to refer, and how to co-manage. I will be asking the questions on behalf of you, the referrers. Today in this episode, I am joined by Dr. Lewis Levitz and Dr. Nima Pakru to discuss all things oculoplastics. In brief, both doctors are highly respected cataract surgeons with special interests in oculoplastics and general ophthalmology. Dr. Lewis Levitz is located at three of our Melbourne clinics, being Camberwell, Coburg and Blackburn, and Dr. Nima Pakru is at our Footscray clinic in Melbourne. Thank you, Lewis and Nima, for joining us today for our podcast episode. So the topic is oculoplastics, and I know often oculoplastics is looked at as sort of lumps and bumps often by referrers, but obviously it's much broader than that, deeper than that. Often a lot of the cases present and they sort of have us on the edge of our seats, a little bit sort of uncomfortable, not knowing exactly how to approach them clinically. So I was hoping today we could, work through that together. And I suppose, Lewis, if we wanted to start with possibly a ptosis patient, you know, how you work through that clinically, what your approach is, your thought process, just to help us feel more confident in that area.
Thank you, Christina. So Christina, Nima and I were actually having a meal about a month ago at a lovely restaurant, and we were discussing various things. And one of the things we were discussing is how to transfer skills to our referrers so that they feel confident when they are faced with cases which are not of the ordinary, and they feel that they can master a topic, and then they can also refer in a way that we understand why they're referring and that they're referring to the correct person. So we thought that maybe we would discuss ptosis, because if you're in a practice and somebody comes in with ptosis, that is not the time to decide to learn neuro-ophthalmology. You have a busy practice, you've got people coming in and out. It could be the end of the day, you've got things to do, and the last thing you want to do is flounder around. Now, if you're at school or when you were at school, I don't know if you remember, there was a thing that if you ever catch a light, if your clothes catch a light, you stop, drop, and roll. When your clothes are light, it's not the time to think, was it stop, roll, drop, or was it roll, drop, stop? You have to have a way of going quickly into a manner of action that gives you a good result. So if somebody comes into my room and they've got ptosis or there's been a referral, and I'll go back to the kind of referral which we'd like to see, you have to go straight into automatic mode. And automatic mode for ptosis is you say to yourself, I'm going to ask myself four or five questions. One, is this congenital or acquired? So you'd either see it in the referral, or you'd ask the patient, have you had this for some time? Did it start suddenly? Did it start gradually? Or does it vary? Because already you know which direction you're going to go. If it's sudden, then it might not be muscle. It might be more likely to be vascular. If it's gradual over time, it could be age-related. And if it's variable, well, it could be a few things, but you'd have to think about myasthenia. Now, the stop, drop, and roll, if you see a patient with a ptosis, the first thing I do is take my pen and I write down what does their pupil look like. Because if you haven't done that, you actually haven't started the process and you're going to flounder. And you have a look, is the pupil normal or is the pupil not normal? Is there anisocoria? And if the pupil is normal, that's good. If the pupil is not normal, the patient probably doesn't need to be in your room. They need to be either in a neuro-ophthalmologist room or in an emergency room, depending on what you find. So I would look at the pupil and I'd say, is a pupil myosed? Do they have a smaller pupil? And if they have a smaller pupil, does that pupil react? Because then already I know I'm heading towards, is a person in front of me, or do they have a Horner's syndrome? And then if you're in an ophthalmologist room or in an optometrist room, you might have apraclonidine drops and you can carry on there. But you don't have to carry on there. At least you know where you are. And that ptosis is not an aponeurotic ptosis. In a similar way, once you're still on your first step, which is a pupil, you have a look and you see, is a pupil dilated? And if you've got a ptosis with a dilated pupil and an ocular motility defect, that person is wasting time in your room. That person probably has a bigger problem and should make their way either immediately to a neuro-ophthalmologist or to a casualty and be imaged, because that's not the kind of thing or ptosis you feel you should be managing. So let's go back to the ptosis that you should be managing. So your patient came in, they've got a ptosis, it's variable or not, you've checked their pupil, you now get to the stop, drop, and roll. The next question you say is it fatigable? So is it acquired? What's their pupil like, and is it fatigable? Now, if it's fatigable, then it's a whole different ballgame. And that you can do in the rooms while you're making your notes, ask them to look up. And if their pupil starts to, their lid starts to drop while you're talking, you know that they might have fatigable ptosis. And then they might have myasthenia. And that's a whole different ballgame. Then your whole mindset goes to neuro-ophthalmology. If it's not fatigable, then it's a normal, probably, and there's no mass on it, and they say that it's a gradual onset, then it's more likely to be an aponeurotic ptosis. Then you can look at them and you can see, do they have the things you taught about, a high lid crease or a thinning of the muscle above the lid crease? Are they elderly? Have they had any other history of anything else which could affect the lid? But until you've done that stop, drop, and roll, until you've seen your patient with a ptosis and asked yourself, is it an acquired ptosis? What is their pupil like? And is it they're fatigable? You actually don't know where you are. So to go back to your question in the beginning, if I get a referral and it says, this is Mr. X, who I'm referring you for ptosis assessment. He feels it is of 4 years duration. It is not fatigable. And there's no pupil involvement. I know that the referrer has thought through the problem and that the person in front of me should be in front of me and not in front of a neuro-ophthalmologist or in an emergency room. And this is something that Nima and I were discussing before, because often we get patients sent to us who maybe should rather be in a neuro-ophthalmology room rather than an oculoplastic room. Nima, what do you think?
So yeah, that's actually interesting what you said, because I had a young lady just the other day with very thing you were talking about. So she came in, she was referred by a local optometrist with ptosis. And I must admit, she walked in, she was in her, I think, late 20s. So I thought she was my age, but I always think everyone's my age. And then I saw she was born in the 1990s, and I felt really old. But so this young lady came in and she said that she's been suffering from ptosis, and the referral said ptosis. And I looked and I thought, well, she looks normal to me. And then just during the conversation, I saw she was actually right. She did start to develop a ptosis. And then that's when I sort of asked her, does this change? And she said, yeah, I've got lots of photos. So I think it's also very important whenever you have a patient with ptosis, the patient themselves, if they're younger, they're generally quite obsessed with the way it looks. So they've probably taken lots of selfies of various times when they're tired or where they've had a few drinks or some other times. And she showed me about 10 photos, and in every photo, the height of the lid was completely different. And that's when I thought, oh, hold on. So I went back to what Lewis said. I sort of checked her pupils, they were equal. She had no other neurological symptoms, no diplopia. And that's when I did the fatigability test. So I sort of measured her palpable aperture using a ruler, and it measured about 8 millimeters. And after getting her to look up for about 30 seconds, it dropped down to about 6 millimeters. And in that case, then I did that good old-fashioned ice test, which I hadn't done for quite a while. So I got the staff to get someone's lunch from the freezer and wrap it up in some kitchen towels and then put it on for about 5 minutes. And lo and behold, the eyelid did actually go up. So in her case, I basically thought, look, she's not a surgical case. She really needs to go and see a neuro-ophthalmologist. I did order the basic blood tests for myasthenia gravis, but often with these cases, if you do suspect myasthenia with variable lid heights, you should really be sending them back to their GP to be sent to a neurologist. The other thing is you do really need to make sure they've got no fatiguability elsewhere. So if you get a patient such as this, I always ask them if they've had any problems breathing, any weakness in any other muscles, because if they do, myasthenia gravis can actually be a systemic disease and it can be a life-threatening systemic disease. So if they do have any other signs of breathing difficulty, chewing, a lot of fatigue in other muscles, then it's more of an emergency case. So you probably should send that patient to emergency, whether it's via their GP or straight to emergency.
They are both, you know, really logical approaches. I like how you've really simplified it. You know, these are cases that when we see them, we do get quite nervous. And I think the way that you have both described approaching them is really applicable and things that we can actually do. We briefly touched on apraclonidine or iopidine. So they're not drops that I commonly see in the fridge in optometry practices, to be honest. I know it is something that way back in uni days we were educated about and trained about. But could you briefly touch on that? Because I know we can get it. So there would be referrers out there listening who would be interested to know how to apply it, what we're looking for when we do apply it, if there are any side effects that we need to look out for, does it have any systemic interactions?
Right. So iopidine or apraclonidine is an alpha agonist, and we'd keep it in an ophthalmology room for after we've done a laser to prevent against an intraocular pressure spike. And that's a good point, because the problem with keeping things in case is that if you do get a bottle of iopidine and you keep it in your optometry room, you might not use it for a year or two or three and it's going to expire. So in that case, I would just refer the patient on. But if you read the textbooks, that's even more ludicrous. They say, you know, apply cocaine. You know, there's no chance anybody's going to have some cocaine. You know, let me go to the fridge and find some, you know, that nobody snorted and I can use it for the patient.
That would be an interesting clinic if they did have it.
So absolutely. So
maybe in another country.
So I'm just saying that apraclonidine is available, you know, easily at your local ophthalmologist, but it's easier to get hold of than any of the other medicines that you're using. And that's why you can also send the person to a neurologist, because they can do muscle fiber tests and they can get to their diagnosis. And what Nima said is very, very true. I had one patient, he was about 42 years old, who was also sent to me for ptosis. And I thought they had myasthenia. And I wrote a letter to the GP. And the next morning I got a phone call that the person was in an ICU because they had a respiratory failure and that they had systemic myasthenia. And, you know, maybe I should have sent the person straight to an emergency room. So these things are very, very rare, but they certainly are out there. And the thing about myasthenia and ptosis is just check the pupils. The pupils will be normal, you know, or usually normal. If you've got a ptosis and an abnormal pupil, it's unlikely to be myasthenia.
And the myasthenia, you can just have myasthenia, which is ocular, which is, I've seen probably 3 or 4 cases in the last 5, 6 years, but there was only one patient that had systemic symptoms. I promptly referred them on to a neurologist who saw them the next day. But if obviously someone comes in gasping for air and they've got ptosis and fatigability, I think that patient needs to go straight to emergency.
Yeah. Nima, how often do you get a patient where you get a referral, please see for ptosis or please see for blepharoplasty? And it's actually difficult to say whether they've got a brow ptosis, whether they've got dermatocolasis, or they've got true ptosis. And it's all sort of lumped with a droopy lid.
Yeah, I must admit, I do get a lot of referrals for ptosis. And then you look at it and it's actually not ptosis, it's excess upper lid skin. It is difficult sometimes because there is a combination of all three of them. So often as we age, the skin stretches. So genetically, some patients, and they say, oh, my sister and my brother have this, and I've come to see you and they're using me as a test case. And it runs in families, and they'll show you pictures of their parents and they say, oh, I start to look like mum. She had all these hoods over her eyes. And you do with these patients often find that their eyebrows are actually quite low as well. So I always tell people, when you look at a young person's eyebrow, it's sitting quite high up on the orbital rim, so just above where your glasses would normally sit. And that often lifts the eyelids quite high. And often I pull their eyebrows up to where I think they should be, and then take a picture and show them and say, look, if your eyebrows were where they should be, your excess skin is actually not that bad. But that's a whole kettle of fish. You can go see a plastic surgeon and have a brow lift, but you'll probably have to sell your house or your children to be able to do that. So often I get them to sort of appreciate that, there's a limit to how much skin you can take off the eyelids. And then I've got a series of, cases that I can show them. But I do find most people in the older age group, so above 65, 70, that get referred to me with upper lid droop, will tend to have a lot of eyebrow ptosis as well. So it's good to set their expectations and sort of let them know that there is a limit to how much you can achieve. It's usually quite a good outcome, but often patients don't have a true ptosis as such, because you look at where the lashes are, and look, as we age, they do drop a little bit, but they do, get lumped in together. But it's quite important to sort of try to go through the different steps and maybe lift up the excess skin. Just see where the eyelashes are sitting. They could be, it could be 1 or 2 millimeters above, below the upper part of the limbus, which is fine. If it's clearing the pupil, then I don't think they necessarily need a ptosis, because they don't want to look, I often say that I don't want to look scared like I've seen a ghost. But then you lift the skin up and actually look at the eyelid height, and then also lift the eyebrows up a little bit and see what result you achieve, because there is usually combined excess skin and brow ptosis. Is that what you find as well, Lewis?
Yeah, that's exactly. So you've got to set expectations. You've got to set the correct expectations. I always tell people, I can cure everything except gravity, and that.
And aging,
yeah.
And I tell them, if you find a way to cure aging, please let me know, because I'm starting to get backaches and all sorts of problems.
Yeah. And I also tell them that if you do have a lid surgery, gravity tends to pull at it, and it doesn't mean that you might not need it again sometime in the future. There's no guarantee that this is going to last a lifetime, because tissues stretch and people do grow older. But I do try to point out to them that, a brow ptosis, if it's a direct repair, will leave a scar. So they've got to have an appetite for what they want, and they've got to understand that there are different kinds of brow drooping or lid drooping or excess skin. There are different ways to approach it, and they can't necessarily have the same operation that their auntie had and have the same result. I'm also, I'm also getting referrals from a lot of plastic surgeons to do fields on patients. Are you getting that as well?
Yeah, I think that's to do with the changing in the Medicare billing.
Yeah. So with the Medicare billing, unless a person has a field defect, or they have scarring, or they have inflammation in their lids because of the ptosis, Medicare is not going to pay. And I don't think anybody is going to want to get involved in doing a ptosis in a blepharoplasty for somebody who doesn't meet those criteria. So the plastic surgeons don't want to get involved in deciding for the patient. So often they'll send the patient to you in the hope that you can tell them that they don't meet the criteria. So the plastic surgeon is not seen as a bad person who tells them that they'd have to pay for it out of pocket and it won't be covered by Medicare. But there are certain criteria, and if they don't meet those criteria, there's no way that Medicare is going to help them with their
I think one thing, just to clarify, sorry, Lewis, to jump in, but Medicare and health funds basically have really tightened what they used to, or become quite stingy in what they used to pay towards blepharoplasty, because I think there were just too many people perhaps claiming medical blepharoplasties when they in fact were more cosmetic. So the rebates have really significantly dropped. So, you know, if you, I still get patients being referred who then come and say, oh, but mine is medical. I thought it was completely covered by Medicare. And, you know, the Medicare rebate for blepharoplasty is, you know, maybe a couple of $100, which, you know, by the time you take in all the costs of clinics and whatnot, you know, if you just go through Medicare, it's probably no one really out there doing blepharoplasties with just a Medicare rebate. And the health funds really only pay a smidgen above what Medicare does these days for blepharoplasty. Most plastic surgeons now don't even go through health funds, because I get patients being referred, being quoted exorbitant amounts of, you know, $6,000 to $10,000 for a blepharoplasty. Generally, ophthalmologists or ocular plastic surgeons don't, in the most part, don't tend to charge such large amounts. Our fees tend to be a lot more reasonable. But it's still, sometimes it's useful to, you know, for referrers to kind of just let patients know that, yes, it is medical, but if it's medical and you've got private insurance, the insurance mainly covers the cost of the hospital, part of the anesthetic and part of the surgery, but they really have clamped down, and you do have to meet all those criteria to even be able to claim. So, you know, if there's large asymmetry, for example, you can claim it if they've got a facial palsy. If a patient's, you know, the folds of skin are touching each other and they're getting sort of eczema or irritation of the skin, then that's claimable. And obviously, if you have a visual field performed and that shows obvious field defects. And we also have to actually take a photo of the patient and put it in their file so that it shows that it's, you know, clinically indicated. That has become a bit harder. Before, it used to be just discretion of the surgeon, but we do now have to document these things. But even with that, it's still not, you know, it's claimable, but it doesn't tend to cover, you know, a large part of, well, a huge portion of the operation. And I sometimes tell patients, look, I had to go have a crown for my tooth. My health fund used to cover, you know, 50, 60% of my, you know, root canal that I had 5 years ago. And this time I went from $2,000, they paid me back about $420. So again, sometimes it's, you know, you don't have to discuss this, but if a patient asks, you can say, look, it does cover part of the surgery, but obviously with just like going to the dentist or a physio, health funds are there to help pay part of the costs. They don't necessarily cover all of it, particularly when it comes to blepharoplasty. For ptosis, it tends to be a lot better. Medicare and health funds do cover a lot more of the ptosis, I find, than blepharoplasty.
One of the criteria there that you have mentioned is facial palsy. Is that what kind of a palsy is that? Is that that's a Bell's palsy type presentation? Can we delve a bit more into that?
Yeah, I've had Bell's palsy patients, and also, seventh nerve palsy. Maybe they've had a tumor, like a parotid tumor that's been operated on, or some other sort of cause of a facial palsy.
With Bell's palsy, I suppose, it's one of those ones, again, similar to ptosis. It presents. It does walk into an optometry room. Sometimes it might go straight to a GP, but often we do find that it comes to us. Help us to confidently work through that type of presentation as well, similar to the ptosis workup.
All right. So I'll talk a little bit, and then Nima, you're welcome to take over. But I talk from a personal experience, because about 2 or 3 years ago, I was working in the garden, and then I came inside and my wife said to me, Lewis, I think you're having a stroke. And I said to her, why? And she said, well, your face has gone funny. So I thought, well, that's nice of you to say. So I went to the mirror and I'd noticed that the bottom half of my cheek was falling down. And I'd noticed about 2 or 3 hours before that when I drank some tea, it was spilling a bit on the face. And I thought maybe I was being clumsy. and I was slurring
a little. Botox? No.
The Botox is to the top. yeah, absolutely. And fillers. And, you know, I immediately, the first thing I did is I went to the mirror and I frowned. Because if you can frown and you can see your frown lines, you're unlikely to have it's unlikely to be a stroke. It's more likely to be a Bell's palsy or something involving the seventh cranial nerve. So I phoned a colleague and they rushed over with some cortisone. But if you see a patient with a Bell's palsy, normally it will come on over a few hours or they'll get it in the morning. And they'll say to you, their speech is changing a little bit. They're having trouble drinking water. And they cannot close their eyes, or they might not know they can't close their eyes. They just feel something tight or pulling or something unusual. And you look at them and you ask them to close their eyes and they've got this white where their eye is and they're rolling up if they've got a good Bell's palsy. And you realize that they've got what could be a Bell's. Now, a Bell's is a diagnosis of exclusion. So we can't start off with a Bell's and then say, well, you've got a Bell's and we'll try and work out what it is. And you first got to work out and make sure that it's not something else. So to do that, you say to yourself, well, I've got to make sure that they don't have a tumor somewhere, whether it's in the parotid gland or in the brainstem. And then you look at them and you see what your findings are. So often they moan about or they complain about a watery eye, that have blurred vision because they're not closing their eyes. So they've got ocular surface disease. They might have a bit of corneal exposure. And the worst, of course, is a lower lid ectropion, and the lower lid is lax, and they've got fluid collecting there, and they can't blink it off, so it collects there and becomes a little bit murky. And just like that stop, drop, and roll analogy, if you see somebody with a Bell's or with a facial nerve palsy, the first thing I think you should do after you've checked that they're not having a stroke is check their corneal sensation, because A, you're checking the fifth cranial nerve and also planning on how you're going to treat them. And after you've done their corneal sensation, you get them to look left and right, and you make sure they don't have a sixth nerve palsy. Because if you have a fifth nerve palsy and a sixth nerve palsy and a seventh nerve palsy, you're in a very different place to just having a Bell's palsy. And then you check their hearing, and you can do a cover-uncover test as well. So you're checking the ocular motility and their hearing. And then the treatment will be according to what you find. So if you were the GP, you'll probably start them on cortisone and some antivirals early, especially if you've looked in their ear and you can see any vesicles and you think that it might be due to a zoster. And then with time, you decide if they're getting better, they might just need a lateral tarsorrhaphy to tide them over while they're getting better. If they're not getting better, then it's a different story. Then they might need weights or gold weights put in their upper lids so that they can close their lids. And in Melbourne, we're fortunate in that we have plastic surgeons that do nerve transplants. So they can move nerves from or graft nerves from one side of the face to the other side of the face, taking muscles from the leg to lift the person's cheek up again. But I think you should definitely have an approach. If you've got somebody with a Bell's or what you think is a seventh nerve palsy, you must know, I need to test the corneal sensation. I need to test hearing. I need to do a cover-uncover test. I need to have all these things done before I write down that they've got a Bell's palsy, because you might not be right.
I was just going to say, so I think if we've got GP listeners, they're probably, you know, even as ophthalmologists, we've forgotten a lot of our medicine. That GPs could probably be in a better position to sort of rule out whether it's rule out a stroke. I would say that most patients I see with Bell's palsy, you know, if they get what you described, Lewis, given, you know, you probably knew what was going on, most people I know go straight to the emergency department. So they come to me via the emergency. And even when they go to emergency, seeing, you know, doctors that see strokes all the time, they still generally end up getting a scan, because we live in a sort of what do they call it, when you just scan everyone just because, you know, the one in a million chance you miss something. So I would suspect that if someone turns up to your optometrist clinic and they've got, you know, a droopy eyelid or droopy face and can't close their eyes, you probably would want to send them at least to their GP on that day or send them to an emergency department.
Can
that be scary?
Yeah. If it's a severe Bell's palsy, so if it's quite noticeable, we would probably be panicking and being like, you need to get out. That brings our first part of this episode to a close. We thank you, listeners, for joining us today. Don't forget to fill in the registration attendance feedback form and add this learning event to your CPD portfolio. Please join us for the next part of this episode.